last item of the day. Updates on predation, pinnipeds, and killer whales. This is a briefing, so we'll turn it over to Mr. Pamplin and Dr. Becker and Mr. Rodding. So take her away, sir.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, commissioners, and directors. My name is Nate Pamplin. I'm the policy director with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Joined today, we've got a great panel. There was a lot of work. I know lining up the agenda and getting everything prepared for this meeting, and this kind of became the catch-all category for a lot of items that we're going to try to shoehorn in your last hour of your agenda today. Why don't we go down the line and do introductions, and we'll jump in.
Commissioners, Sean Clements, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Senior Policy Analyst, talking about pinnipeds today.
Commissioners, I'm Dan Rodding. I work for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife on salmon recovery issues on the Columbia River.
Hello, Commissioners. Dr. Penny Becker, and I am currently the killer whale policy lead.
Commissioners, James Lawan. I'm the avian predation coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
So as you know, there are hundreds of millions of dollars of ratepayer, license payer, and taxpayer dollars that are spent on salmon recovery in the Columbia River Basin every year. And the majority of that focus is on those four H's: habitat, hydropower, hatcheries, and harvest. Kind of more recently, the portfolio has been expanded as we've made progress or stabilized some of the threats to salmon survival on those other four H's. Our attention as agencies has really turned to some of those other factors. And so today our panel will walk through each of those items, starting with Dan.
Thank you, Nate. So today, I'm excited to kick off the presentation, and what I'm going to talk about is fish predation and management in the Columbia River for juvenile salmonids. Next. So what I wanted to go through today is sort of highlight the risks due to juvenile salmonids due to an altered ecosystem in the Columbia Basin. Talk about ongoing predation management. I'm going to do two case studies. One is northern pike minnow, and the other one is northern pike, not to be confused, because they confuse me at times. And then the last one is I'll just summarize the presentation at the end. So this is a shot of the Columbia Basin today. It's got a lot of dams on it, and there's actually over 144 dams on the main stem and in major tributaries. You can see the map doesn't even have the Deschutes or Willamette on there, so there's a lot of dams that are in the basin that aren't there. Juvenile salmon evolved in a different ecosystem, and so the way that they evolved to minimize predation was they migrated during the spring and summer freshet in the Columbia Basin. And so if they did that, they could get to the ocean quickly. And the second thing is that during that freshet, the river would become very turbid. And so predators would not be able to see them. So now what we've done is that we've created many what we call storage reservoirs up in Canada and in Idaho. And what that's done is it's really changed the hydrograph for the flow of the Columbia system. So we can go back to the late 1800s and look at the Dalles hydrograph, which is in blue there. And you can see that the shape of the hydrograph is higher, and it is more spread out than it is currently today, which is the red hydrograph. So if you're a salmon, historically, if you're a yearling, so those would be steelhead, coho, spring chinook, sockeye, you would migrate during this time. And you can see that there's less flow available for them to migrate during that time. If you're a sub-yearling or you go out at age zero, your fall chinook or a summer chinook, you also migrated during the near the peak of the hydrograph, and there's also less flow. So now you're becoming more available to predators because there's less flow. The second thing is that we changed it from a free-flowing river to a series of reservoirs. And the water travel time through reservoirs is a lot slower than it is from in a free-flowing river. So therefore, fish are more exposed because it takes them longer to get through the reservoirs than it did the free-flowing river. And the third thing that we've done, you've talked a little bit about temperature this morning, is that this is the maximum temperature at Bonneville Dam by year from 1938 to the present. And the red line is the trend in that temperature. And you can see that it's gone up from 1938 to the present by about 2 or 3 degrees. So why does this matter? It matters because what happens is that predators, their metabolism or their activity rate increases when it's warmer. And so that means they need more, need to consume more prey, including juvenile salmon. So with that background, I'm going to jump into the Northern Pike Minnow Program. And Northern pike are native fish to the Northwest throughout Oregon, Washington, and then the Columbia River. And due to the altered ecosystem, the reservoirs, the northern pike minnow population exploded after the construction of the reservoirs. And after these fish get about 9 inches in length, they switch over from eating lots of different things to primarily trying to prey on fishes and crayfish and other large food items. So in order to address this issue, predation was limited by, we took two management actions. One was a sport reward fishery for northern pike minnow, and the second is dam angling, where anglers from the Department of Fish and Wildlife actually removed northern pike minnow from the forebays and tail races of selected dams. So, as I said, the purpose of the program, or the objective of the program, was to increase juvenile survival by removing large predators in the Columbia and Snake River systems. And we had a goal of reducing the population annually by about 10%. And that was going to achieve a balance of salmon recovery and still protecting the population. This is a multi-level agency effort. Bonneville funds a lot of the work. Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission administers the program and keeps track of the angling vouchers or the sport reward portion. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife mans the sport check station, so they check in all the fish, and as the fish come in, they go ahead and account for those. And then lastly, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife does a biological assessment to make sure that we're meeting the goals of the program. So when we take a look at the pike minnow program, it started in 1991, and it's averaged about 150,000 fish are removed each year. And remember, one of the goals was to have a harvest rate or an exploitation rate of about 10 to 20% a year. And this graph on the right shows that we have successfully done that since the start of the program in 91. And in summary, we've reduced predation from this program by about 27%. In 2017 compared to the baseline, which would be 1990. So it's been a successful program. Costs of the program are about $4.5 million a year, and a little bit under $2 million a year are paid to anglers for sport reward fishery. The rest of the program is to implement the program. And I just want to point out that this isn't the only predator removal program. The PUD is in Washington, so they operate in the area above, on the Columbia River, above the confluence of the Snake, also have a predator removal program for northern pike. Now I'm going to jump over to northern pike. very much a different critter than northern pike minnow. They are average about 18 inches, and they can get up to almost 60 inches. They really look and behave like a freshwater barracuda. So if we go through and take a look, in Washington, they were illegally introduced from Montana into the Pend'Oreille River, and then now they're in Lake Roosevelt. And to remind everyone, Lake Roosevelt is behind Grand Coulee Dam. The next dam down is Chief Joseph. If they get past that, then they are in the anadromous zone in the Columbia River. They're a serious threat to native fishes, and they may be a serious threat to the native fish communities in the Pend'Oreille, in Lake Roosevelt, and if they move downstream, they will be a serious threat to anadromous fishes. In 2012, the Kalispell Tribe and WFW began suppression efforts, and those have moved on to Lake Roosevelt. So first I'll talk about suppression efforts in Box Canyon or the Pend'Oreille River. So the population assessment showed us there were only about 400 pike in about 2006, but that exploded to over 5,000 pike by 2010. By the time we were able to get a program squared away in 2012, we did some planning. We had a goal of trying to suppress the pike population by 87%. We use a combination of anglers for harvesting fish, fishing derbies, and gill nets are the most effective tool that we have. And so we've removed over 17,000 pike from Box Canyon from 2012 to 2017, and we've met our target reduction goal. But it's going to be an ongoing issue for us. We have not figured out how to eradicate pike. What we're doing is suppressing them. They've moved down to Lake Roosevelt, down from Box Canyon, and one study on Lake Roosevelt showed that 76% of the fish that they consume were kokanee, rainbow trout, and whitefish. So there have some severe impacts on native fishes. Tribal and state managers have been actively suppressing pike since 2015, and there's many partners in this effort, including the state and the co-managers, BPA, the local public utility districts in the Upper Columbia, Northwest Pound Planning Council, and the Park Service. So if we're going to be successful at dealing with predatory fishes, we need to have public involvement and outreach. We do this through a variety of methods, whether it's on the website, within fishing regulations, or through signage. And we've also gone ahead and expanded in Lake Roosevelt. We are also now awarding funds for the return of heads of northern pike in the reservoir. So we have a sport reward fishery for them there as well. So in summary, for predatory fish management, the altered Columbia River ecosystem, climate change, and illegal reductions are going to require continued predatory management efforts and actions. The second thing is that I've showed you that we think we've demonstrated a success story with a balance of preserving the native fish, northern pike minnow, and getting some benefits for juvenile salmon through the sport reward fishery. We've also demonstrated how a successful suppression effort in Box Canyon. But eradication is really not an option here, at least of right now. So we're going to require continued vigilance. The thing most managers are worried about is pike have gradually moved from Montana to Idaho. Now they're in the top of the Columbia River system, and they're working their way down. We are really concerned if they're able to move down over Grand Coulee and over Chief Joseph and get established in the anadromous zone. And lastly, anytime we're dealing with invasive species, especially predatory fishes, there's a couple of key things that we can do. So one is early detection and rapid response. Two is public outreach. Three is aggressive actions to stop the control and expansion of predators. And lastly, it's to go ahead and we need adequate funding to do the work. So I had about 10 minutes, and I know that's a lot to soak in. I left you some resources. The first one is a report from the ISAB, which is the science panel for the Northwest Power Planning Council that generally talks about predation in the Columbia River. The Pike Minnow website, a report from or a presentation from ODFNW on the Northern Pike Minnow program, and a couple links, one to the department's website on Northern Pike, and a recent presentation to the council in Northern Pike. And that's what I had for you.
Thank you. I have a question. A couple of, coming from the Upper Great Lakes, though, it does hurt me to see Pike like that. It's all one in perspective. But that said, I appreciate it. The public outreach, how... Is that statewide? Or?
So there's definitely the focus is where we have the critter, where we have the pike, which is in Northeast Washington, which is in Region 1. That's where most of the focus on the outreach has been. But they're highlighted, you know, through the website. They're highlighted in our angling regulations pamphlet. So we're trying to go ahead and get the word out as best we can.
In the fishing derbies, I mean, pike are a good fighting fish, you know, and it would be great for experience for a young person to, you know, hook into a big pike, as I can attest to. So I don't know, maybe we can just talk later about that, because I think there could be some opportunities.
That'd be great. I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Yes. Mr. Grable.
A lot of the outreach has been, that I'm aware of, has been the Colville tribe. They're the ones, I think BPA funds their angler reward program, and they do a good job of disseminating that information. And as you say, it's primarily within that region of interest where they're locally accessible. And I, too, would look forward to the opportunity to fish for them, which I haven't yet, but I also have a meeting coming up shortly after I get back with the Colville Tribe and Chelan County PUD to address this issue, because it's alarming, and I think, as you mentioned, we're attempting to suppress the population, but elimination is going to be very difficult. Thank you very much, Dan, for a good treatment of that.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Chair Finley. Have you used commercial gill netters on the lake?
No, we haven't. I'm most familiar with the Box Canyon work, and actually the success of that actually had to do with some biologists getting together, radio tagging some fish, and finding out that they concentrated in a few areas for spawning. And because of that, the gill nets were extremely successful in go ahead and in managing the population. There are other places that have used commercial gill netters for those, and that's not off the table. But right now, we're not pursuing that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Buckmaster.
Slide, the last slide on the pike minnow with the two graphs. You talk about program costs $4.5 million with $1.8 million paid to anglers. Is that an annual or is that money to date?
That's annually.
Okay. And you talk about reduced predation on juvenile salmon by 27%. How many 9-inch fish does that $4.5 million remove?
So on the graph on the right, it removes about 150,000 fish a year.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Any other? Yeah. Commissioner Thunberg?
Yeah, I would just comment on a couple of the comments I've heard from commissioners. First, as our chair's comments point out, the public outreach has been really important and quite visible in Region 1. We've also had really excellent news coverage of this as an alarming issue. So I do think it's important, though, to make it statewide to an extent. And then in reference to commercial gill netting, there would have to be a lot of groundwork to that, I think. I think there'd be some real pushback from some of our lake fishers who are absolutely convinced that it's being used to remove other non-native species, and that's really the reason that we're there. So.
Other questions?
Trade seats with me, or I can drive from here.
It should be easier to walk to the office, yes.
I think Commissioner Grable could get some good visibility out on for a day pike fishing out there on.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is James Lawan. I will be giving you an update today on three pretty major federally led avian predation plans in the Columbia Basin. These plans are all nearing completion, but they haven't all of them quite gone as according to plan, and so I'll be describing that. Just as a note, there's a considerable amount of nuance associated with all these plans, and I'm going to be leaving that nuance out. I'm going to tell you basically a story behind that all these plans basically share in common, and any nuance can be, I can address that following the talk. So all the avian plans were initially conceived of to serve as mitigation for federal hydro system mortality to Endangered Species Act listed salmon. And so what you see here on the slide is a photo of Bonneville Dam and a Caspian Tern. So they both contribute to system-wide mortality. The idea is if we reduce mortality on the avian side, we can partially compensate for some of the mortality that's happening at the dams. These plans, as I mentioned, are federal plans. There are a variety of agencies that have contributed to them. Most prominent among them is the Army Corps of Engineers. The states do have limited, we do contribute to these plans, but we have limited executive authority, really no executive authority. So this is one of the players in our story. This is a double-crested cormorant. Many of you are likely fairly familiar with this species. It has grown. It is a Pacific Northwest native. Populations have grown from radically over the last 40 years. Populations in the Columbia River estuary have grown from around 100 breeding pairs in the late 70s to around 13,000 breeding pairs in the 2000s. So really a dramatic increase. The takeaway is these birds are consuming between 2 and 7% on average of ESA listed upriver derived salmon. These are salmon that are passing through the hydro system. Many of you who are really acquainted with the issue know that cormorants can consume considerably higher numbers of salmon, especially those that are derived downstream of Bonneville. We've seen predation rates over 20%, but we have much less data for those runs. And since I'm going to be focusing more on hydro system, the nexus between the hydro system and avian predation for my talk today. So that's where this 2.7% of available fish comes from. The other big actor in our story is the Caspian Tern. This is also a Pacific Northwest native. Populations for this species have also increased radically over the last 40 years. Several hundred pairs in the basin in the late 1970s to up to and in excess of 10,000 in the 2000s. This species also consumes a considerable proportion of upriver salmonids up to 16%. Steelhead in particular are very vulnerable to tern predation. So I'll leave it at that for now. The first plan that I'll talk about is probably the least well-known plan. It does involve Caspian terns. The idea was to address the two largest Caspian tern breeding colonies on the Columbia Plateau region of southeast Washington. You can see Kennewick on the map. The two colonies that I'm talking about are illustrated on the slide with white circles. The idea was preclude tern nesting at these colonies, and the terns will leave the basin. Well, that isn't quite what happened. Many terns simply shifted their distribution elsewhere within the Columbia Plateau region. On the map, you can see the orange circle illustrates the Blaylock Islands. They're a series of islands administered by the Umatilla National Wildlife Refuge, and the refuge is not allowing tern management on those islands. So the terns that have managed to find those islands are basically home free to continue consuming upriver-derived salmon. Now, despite this change in distribution within the plateau, there have been measurable benefits. Upriver steelhead, in particular, have seen pretty measurable increases in survival rates, or decreases in mortality rates, I should say. But on the other hand, we've seen slight increases in mortality from Snake River stocks, Snake River steelhead, and Snake River sockeye as a result of this distribution further downstream in the hydro system. Basically, these birds now have access to more Snake River fish. One caveat with these data, this only represents 4 years of data, and there can be considerable interannual variations. So that's the thing with these data that you see in front of you. The second management plan is probably a bit more familiar to many of you. It is the Caspian tern management plan for the Columbia River estuary on East Sand Island. East Sand Island formerly supported about 10,000 breeding pairs of Caspian terns. The idea was behind this plan was to reduce the amount of available breeding habitat on the island and thus reduce the number of terns. Well, from 2008 to 2000, or to the present actually, the colony size has been reduced from 6 acres to 1 acre, and we've seen a pretty considerable reduction in the number of breeding Caspian terns using that island, and associated with that, really a sizable gain in survival, and we should be proud of that. However, predation rates and the number of terns still present there are in excess of the target for this plan. The current plan does not allow for any additional reductions of the colony size here, and so we're kind of stuck because the plan has written into it this colony shall not be less than 1 acre. It didn't address number of birds, it addressed acreage of habitat. So this one, while there were gains, didn't quite turn out exactly as expected. And possibly the best known of the three plans, and also likely the most controversial, was the double-crested cormorant management plan for the Columbia River estuary. The idea here was to reduce the amount of breeding habitat on East Sand Island, the major breeding colony in the estuary, and by doing so, reduce the overall number of cormorants and the overall number of the overall amount of cormorant predation in the estuary. Well, as you can see from the photo in the slide, and for those in the audience who can't quite see as well, this is a picture of the Astoria Megler Bridge, and all those bumps you see on it are hundreds of cormorants. The size of the breeding colony on the Astoria Megler Bridge has quadrupled over the last 4 years, overlapping with the period that the Army Corps of Engineers in this case has been managing on East Sand Island. It's now expected that the bridge could support up to 3,500 breeding pairs of cormorants, and that's very problematic because the Astoria-Megler Bridge is farther upstream from East Sand Island, and we have evidence indicates that these birds will, per capita, per cormorant, consume considerably more salmon than cormorants using East Sand Island. We estimate about twice as many, at least. And so when we add together the number of cormorants we expect will remain on East Sand Island post-plan, with the number of cormorants using the Astoria-Megler Bridge, as well as a few other colony sites, it right now doesn't seem that there will be any benefits to this plan at all. And there is a possibility that predation rates could actually be a little bit worse. As far as management of birds on the bridge goes, the Army Corps of Engineers, who is the lead federal agency for this project, is now they maintain that they have no authority to manage those cormorants, and so basically this plan is at an impasse.
Our commission has heard me say this, and you probably have as well, but again, going back to the Upper Great Lakes, where cormorants came in a large, from nothing to rafts of thousands out in front, but they've been managed very successfully in the last decade, or the last 5 years, really. Oiling of the eggs, plus number six shot. And now, when I'm back visiting family, I'll see one or two lonely ones flying around. But there, the perch population, which is the target one there, as well as smolts too for salmon up there, has rebounded. So when you say that the Army Corps says they can't do it, there is precedent for that being done, and it's Fish and Wildlife that's doing it in the Upper Great Lakes.
Mr. Chair, that the Army Corps, when they're saying they have no authority statutorily to address the cormorant issue on the bridge, there is we know quite well what could be done to address the issue. It's simply that as an agency, their position is they have no federal authority to do anything about it.
Have they consulted with Interior Fish and Wildlife on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been intimately involved with this plan. I did mean to mention that this plan was controversial because it included quite a bit of culling of cormorants, of adult cormorants, as well as nest take. Eggs were oiled. And the reason that was done was to prevent dispersal from happening. Things didn't go quite according to plan, but the sticking point for the cormorants using the bridge is not so much that we can't or we don't know how. It's how to say it? No one is. The horns of this bull are not being grabbed, and they probably ought to be.
Unique way of saying it, but I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And this, just for the final slide, as a wrap up. So these three avian plans are very close to being finished. Yet, we really have seen some measurable gains for two of these plans. However, we haven't seen the ultimate biological targets for any of these plans being met, and that does have hydrosystem implications. These plans were initially thought of to address hydrosystem mortality, so we need to consider that. And right now, there's not a current pathway forward to addressing the shortcomings of these plans. It does seem at this point that if we do want to see a change in these plans, that new plans will actually need to be drawn up by federal agencies. And I don't know if I have any time left for questions, but if so, I'd be happy to take any.
Yes. Chair Finley.
I'm just curious about the mergansers, what you've seen statewide even.
Mr. Chair, the mergansers do consume a considerable I mean, from a bioenergetic standpoint, basically looking at how many calories a merganser needs to keep going and to breed, they can consume considerable numbers of salmon or of salmon of smolts. We do have fairly good information on merganser populations all across the state, at least in the major estuaries, and the depending on the drainage you're in, there are more, there are fewer, but generally speaking, we're a bit more concerned with cormorants because they're consuming fish that have already made it to the estuary, and so the mortality that they affect on fish is more likely to translate into effects on adult runs than effects of mergansers on younger fish.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Commissioner Baker.
Understanding this is a meeting primarily centered on Columbia River, but I live on Puget Sound, and there are a whole bunch more cormorants than there used to be in the Sound. Are we looking at that as well, or do we have any plans and processes to reduce the number on the Sound?
Commissioner Baker, the Sound is actually a major overwintering area. We know that from satellite telemetry studies done actually as part of some of these management plans, federal studies. The question you're getting at is one that is a bit outside the authority of the states because it is the double-crested cormorants are a Migratory Bird Treaty Act listed species, and as such, they are managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, we, as the state of Oregon now is actually all across the West, states are having a new discussion with U.S. Fish and Wildlife about what cormorant populations in the West ought to be, but the decision-making authority does rest with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, but it is no doubt that it's no doubt that you are seeing more cormorants, and that's because of there are more birds simply in the western population than there had been.
Yep.
Commissioner Baker, I can help a little bit from the Washington perspective. As part of the cormorant plan, there was also follow-up monitoring of particular sites for cormorants. So Fish and Wildlife Service has been on point for establishing those in Washington and the other states as well. And WDFW has been doing some monitoring of cormorants over the last several years and looking at if those numbers have changed over time. So we are monitoring that.
Other questions? Thank you.
So shifting over to pinniped predation at Bonneville to start, this is an interesting collision of the Northwest Power Act, Endangered Species Act, and the Marine Mammal Protection Act in this case study. And I want to begin by also acknowledging a number of partners on this effort, both states of Washington and Oregon, Idaho's engaged, the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, the Army Corps of Engineers, NIMS, as well as U.S. Department of Agriculture all have staff and resources invested in helping to mitigate this challenge. Bonneville Dam sits at River Mile 145, and California sea lions first started showing up probably in the 90s sporadically, but then more consistently. We started seeing breeding males come in the spring time frame, beginning regularly at 2002, and that's been very steady ever since. Stellar sea lions started to show up around 2003, and again, their prevalence has also increased here more recently. Initially, we worked really hard on a variety of non-lethal measures. Physical barriers of keeping sea lions out of the fishways work pretty well, but almost all of the other deterrents don't. In particular, we've tried everything from acoustic deterrents, hazing, as well as just trying to relocate animals, only to find that within a handful of days, they swim back. We applied, the states received a letter of authorization for, under Section 120 of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, originally back in 2008, and then it was extended in 2012 and again in 2016. The removal criteria that's identified both in terms of the Marine Mammal Protection Act as well as in our permit is that each California sea lion must be individually identifiable. So this requires a catch and release effort. We have to catch the animal, brand the animal, and then release it. Once it's marked, then we have to observe that animal that's been hanging out at Bonneville Dam for at least 5 days. We need to observe that that sea lion has actually consumed a salmon, and that we have to document that that sea lion has been subjected to hazing. Once all those conditions are met, then we apply to have that animal added to a list that NMFS approves, such that if we capture it again, we can then remove it. And I would point out the challenge of this effort. This is incredibly resource intensive, not only for the catch and release, but also with the Army Corps of Engineers staff and others that are monitoring. And you can only see a predation event at most probably 400 yards away from Bonneville Dam. And of course, these are animals that when they're at the surface, they're flailing around, and you may not see it where the back is turned, and you can perfectly read the brand. Instead, it's zipping through the water. And was that C-104 or was that C-140? I have no idea. So incredibly challenging effort, and it takes a lot of time and energy to finally have an animal to meet all those conditions and then apply to NMFS to have it added to the list. We just got the data from the Army Corps of Engineers for 2018 field season this morning. So I'm presenting to you a high-level summary of the 2017 effort, where there was 90 California sea lions and 60 Steller sea lions observed at Bonneville Dam. Just based on the predation that's observed, again, within probably that first 400 yards of the dam face, California sea lions consume about 2% of the salmon run, while stellars consume about 3%. They've been subjected to hazing, and last year we removed 24 California sea lions. This year we removed almost 30. This slide just shares presents some data from the Army Corps Fisheries Field Unit, and just wanted to highlight that the shaded area of the graph is average number of California sea lions that are prevalent at Bonneville Dam between the 7 years of 2008 to 2014. The red line shows 3 years of average daily abundance of 15 through 17, and the black line shows 2018. A couple highlights here. First, we're seeing fewer California sea lions showing up at the dam, but then secondly, Steller sea lions are showing up in really big numbers, and they're around for longer parts of the year. Just last week, we had on average 35 Steller sea lions at Bonneville Dam. The high was 47 counted last week. And this really is, as kind of thinking about the future of the program here, where our permit is only currently for California sea lion removals. Steller sea lions are substantially larger animals and will provide even a greater logistic challenge in terms of if we have to follow similar Section 120 requirements to have them be individually identifiable. That requires us to capture and brand and release a one-ton animal rather than an animal that weighs a male California sea lion can range between, 400 pounds. A large male might be up to 800 to 1,000 pounds. The Steller sea lions can be up to a ton. And so that presents a variety of other staff challenges, including just staff safety for handling such large animals. It can be done, and we're hoping to do some tests and some additional feasibility of being able to consistently begin trapping and branding Steller sea lions this fall and do a pilot effort there, knowing that we want to have more Steller sea lions branded and marked such that we'd be able to potentially in the future apply for another Section 120 permit to address this growing problem. Since we were first received the letter of authorization in 2008, we've removed 200 California sea lions. There's, in addition to the euthanized of 196 animals, we've had a few animals die during the capture event, and we've placed some animals into aquaria. In March, the co-managers submitted a letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service asking for a few items relative to this program. One was to expeditiously review Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Section 120 application that Dr. Clements is going to talk about here shortly. And we also asked that NIMS adopt some of the recommendations from the Pinniped Task Force. This is a group that's assembled per the Marine Mammal Protection Act to provide oversight and guidance to NIMS as they regulate this removal program. One edit that the task force recommended was to modify one of the criteria. Instead of having to be individually identifiable that the sea lion eats the salmon and has been observed in the area, just change that to an or. That would allow us to be a lot more efficient, as well as we've asked that they reduce the observation days from 5 to 3. So shifting a little bit from Bonneville Dam and just talking about some other efforts that we have underway in Washington, there was a couple papers that were published that I wanted to highlight for you. One was a Chasco paper that came out in 2017. And that paper indicated that across kind of the eastern North Pacific and Salish Sea, that for harbor seals, that the estimated consumption rate by harbor seals of salmonids is twice as much as killer whales and 6 times as much as the combined harvest of commercial and recreational fishers. Another publication that came out this year by Nelson indicated that the density of harbor seals was negatively associated with Chinook production, wild Chinook production. They also looked at the amount of hatchery releases and found that that was not a correlation and a link. So this really prompted pinnipeds really came up in a big way in a variety of different policy arenas. The Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force, assembled by Governor Inslee, it's come up in terms of the Pacific Salmon Treaty negotiations, and it's come up in the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan. This is the take permit that the co-managers, the Northwest Indian Treaty Tribes and Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife need to be able to have an ESA take permit for fisheries in Puget Sound. It's a 10-year plan. We submitted a draft in December of last year. NIMS had determined it was insufficient. As we went back to the drawing board, one of the items that the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission said for us to do was look at what we can do to improve salmon habitat restoration, look what we can do for conservation hatcheries, and what else can we do for pinniped predation. So that launched an effort that we've been doing for the past 7 or 8 months, and really trying to take some of the data from the Chasco paper and drill it down to pinniped management units that, and understanding what's going on at a more localized level that we think that we can try to influence from a management perspective. So we're pulling together more recent population estimates for harbor seals, California sea lions, and stellar sea lions. We're organizing that data into these smaller areas where we have regionally specific pinniped diet data. We're incorporating that into the model. A lot of the diet and bioenergetics information may come from a study that was, you know, kind of outside the mouth of the Fraser River. Well, there's going to be a lot more salmon that are going to be consumed there than, for instance, in South Puget Sound. And where we have that data, let's plug it in, because we recognize the scrutiny of any type of management program that'll be underway and want to have use that localized information when it's available. We're also pulling together information and working with tribes to collect their smolt data and adult data so that we have that available in those smaller areas, and then be able to essentially assess the impact of consumption by pinnipeds compared to other factors, and ultimately be able to estimate the number of removals that may be needed to actually increase marine survival and recruitment in those certain geographic areas. And then that information will then really inform the next step, which is what are our administrative options and some of the socio-political considerations. Just want to take you down a quick stroll under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And I would highlight just the name. It's not the Marine Mammal Management Act. It's not the Marine Mammal Conservation Act. It's the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And the authors in 1972 did an incredible job making sure that marine mammals were protected. And considering the populations that were imperiled and the controversy around the dolphin fishery and the status of great whales, status of pinniped populations, it was probably the right call at the time. But there is not much flexibility within the Marine Mammal Protection Act. There are three ways that you can actually conduct removals. I'll start at the bottom, which was Section 120, and that's the permit that I just described for at Bonneville, and all of its associated limitations. When you think about those requirements of having animals being individually identifiable, like for you to imagine what that would look like if you were to apply that in Puget Sound or the Washington Outer Coast, and how we don't have that perch of Bonneville Dam to actually watch the predation events and understand what marked animals are eating what and for how long, and then apply for those animals to be on a permit. Another management option is to request return of management authority back to the states. That's under Section 109. It has not been successfully implemented in the almost 50 years of the MMPA. It has a couple other challenges, is that the marine mammal population or stock needs to be at an optimum sustainable population size. And so when we look at harbor seal stocks in Washington, NMPS has not done a determination at that level yet. So that's just one small barrier, but a barrier I wanted to point out. The other aspect of this is it's not just a return of management authority for certain elements. It would be handing us the components of the Marine Mammal Protection Act for those stocks that are at OSP and turning that over to the state. So we're looking at, you know, having the resources to do all the other aspects of work that the National Marine Fisheries Service does to evaluate a variety of takes. So, for instance, construction at a Navy installation that might bounce some harbor seals at a haul-out site. And so from one perspective, that feels like really low, a lot of effort with low conservation return to have to evaluate some of those types of permits. Applications. The one benefit of under Section 109 is it actually is exempt from NEPA, so there wouldn't have to be an EIS or an environmental assessment done for that measure. The final option is just to apply for a waiver of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and request a permit for direct take. It hits a variety of sections under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Over the past 4.5 decades, there's probably been less than 10 permits that have been applied for, even fewer that have been processed by NMPS. One example in the Northwest, an application was submitted for a waiver in 2005, and it's still under review. The last item I just wanted to highlight was that the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission at their August meeting adopted a policy position on pinniped management. It's in your packets. I won't go through all the details, but essentially the commission advocated for greater management flexibility under federal legislation, that if such authorities were granted, that the director move expeditiously to file an application, and that we would pursue both non-lethal and lethal measures. So before I turn it over to Dr. Clements, are there any questions?
Commissioner Holzman.
What's the status of the Jamie Herrera Butler's bill? And if it's still in play, what does that call for?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Holzmiller, I know that's a topic that Dr. Clements is going to talk about here in just shortly. So okay. If I can, I'll just defer to him.
Oh, that's fine.
Walk through the latest.
Okay. Yes, Commissioner Grable.
You've indicated that, looking at the graph that showed populations of both Stellar and California sea lions present at Bonneville during certain times of year, I remember visiting Astoria about 4 years ago, and the estimated numbers of these on the docks was like 20,000. It was a lot more than the numbers that are indicated here, it seems.
Yes, and so this chart just shows at Bonneville Dam, looking at kind of the lower Columbia River, I believe the estimate's around 2,000 to 3,000 California sea lions.
Okay, so what I'm saying is the presence of the sea lions from the mouth to Bonneville is significantly higher than that are present just at the dam.
And Commissioner Graybill, that's an excellent point, and I should point out as well that this estimated predation on this particular slide is just the predation events at Bonneville Dam. The National Marine Fisheries Service did a study around 2013, 2014, where they had some fish that were marked and released and tracked their fate, and they had, losses at the range of 20% to 43% that they attributed to pinnipeds.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. The Astoria expert now?
Well, it's like living in a kennel.
I served on the original salmonid pinniped interaction task force. And the question that we could not get answered was what my colleague from Washington was addressing. What was the cumulative consumption of the to these runs within the river. We asked them to use mass balance based on weight gain and using conservative numbers at every stage of the game, from population to what percent of their diet to being clumsy hunters to everything. We still came up on a notepad of over 20%, but it was very clear that was outside of the realm of what we were addressing on that task force, which was only the Section 120. It was only at observable from Bonneville. I think the Section 120 request is the same. I think if we can come up with a good number, it aids us as far as communicating with the general population. But in that form, we could not get a number. So the number that you just gave is really good. And just looking at the 4.7% that you identify by the 155 animals, if you multiply that, if you do a factor of 10, that gets you to 47% of the run. And we know we have more than 1,550 animals in the river. So,
Commissioners, I'm going to be talking about three topics today. One, just to give you an update on what's happening at Willamette Falls. Two, to talk about the federal legislation that you were just talking about, and where we are with that. Kind of noisy here. Turn that down. And three, we're going to talk about regional management. So this happens to be a camera that was attached to a Stellar sea lion by National Geographic a few years back. Our staff assured them that when they put their multiple $1,000 cameras on, they would get them back. And as soon as they put them on, the Stellas bolted from Bonneville Dam down to Astoria, and they never got one back and recovered one on the beach, and that's what we got. You can see Astoria Bridge with the cormorants in the background there. So I'm going to start off talking about Willamette Falls, and for our Washington colleagues that maybe have heard about it but haven't seen it, this is Willamette Falls. It's kind of a horseshoe shape, and in that horseshoe and just below there, in April and May, we can have up to 40 California sea lions there in the last couple of years. So it's a small area relative to Bonneville, and that concentration of sea lions can do some pretty significant damage to our fish stocks. So, actually, I'll just back up. So a couple of things to point out here. We do have three fish ladders at Willamette Falls, three entrances where the fish can get through. The ones in the kind of, or two of them are in the horseshoe area, and one's in just below the powerhouse where PGE on the left side of the picture there has a hydro facility. And so fish tend to delay here. They've always delayed naturally, but they also delay just to find the entrances and get through, and this obviously provides more opportunity for sea lions to prey on them, and they do that fairly effectively. In terms of what we're seeing there, in the late 90s, early 2000s, we had very low numbers of sea lions, and when our folks looked at what they were preying on, it was in the low hundreds of fish, so it wasn't really a concern. Obviously, given what happened at Bella Locks and what happened at Bonneville, we were concerned that this was going to increase at the time, but as you've heard from Nate, there really is no opportunity at that point to do any kind of management, so you just have to wait, essentially. So wait we did, and in the around 2010, we had information that there was more sea lions coming to Willamette Falls and that predation was increasing. So we resumed monitoring, and then in 2015, around 2013, we had that massive influx into the Columbia Basin. Numbers went from low hundreds in the basin to up to 3,000, and that was associated with change in ocean conditions and a lot of males moving north to follow food. And with that big increase in the population in Astoria, you get a certain percentage of these animals that move upriver, and it's about 7% of the ones in Astoria will move upriver. So around 2013-14, we had increased the numbers both at Bonneville and at Willamette Falls. This, the number in red shows a single-day maximum number of individuals we have at the falls. So on a given day in 2017, we had up to 40 California sea lions there. We think the population at the falls is somewhere between 50 and 100 individuals total, but because a lot of these animals are unmarked, it's tough to know for sure. In the background there, you can see in the gray just what's happening to the steelhead run. It was in the close to 20,000s in the early 2000s, and since then it's been steadily downhill. Last 2 years, we've had the lowest runs on record, 512 fish in 2017, and somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 in the last year, 2018. So that population is in dire straits. These are the predation rates that we've been observing at the falls for the last 5 years now. Just added 2018, they just came out. Steelhead are in red, and Chinook, spring Chinook are in blue. These are both wild stocks. For the last 2 years, predation on winter steelhead at the falls has been over 20%. It was 25 in 2017 and 22 this last year, which is... Again, this is within a small area close to Willamette Falls, probably about less than a mile. Obviously, as you pointed out, there's predation going on downstream, but within the small area, we're losing a quarter of our returning spawners. Spring Chinook, it's lower, and it doesn't get as much attention because it's lower, but it's still significantly higher than what we see at Bonneville, 7 to 9% of our spring Chinook stock. And the other thing that's important to note here is that they're preying on the early returning spring Chinook, which is probably our healthiest stock at Mackenzie, and probably also the fish that are most resilient to climate change because they're coming earlier. So Dr. Matt Falsey in Corvallis used some of this predation data and some of our stock assessment data to run some PVAs for spring Chinook and steelhead. You might have seen some of these numbers in the press. For winter steelhead, for any we're looking at a probability of extinction for any one of the three stocks of close to 89%. So if we do nothing, and predation kind of continues at the level that it's been at the last couple of years. If we can manage that predation down to zero, then our probability of extinction for those populations goes down to 6%. So it's probably the single biggest factor explaining extinction risk for that stock at the moment, or it is the single biggest factor. The extinction risk obviously varies across the populations. I think it runs from like 20% in the Malala to 60-something percent in the Santiams. Spring Chinook, these numbers came, Dr. Fauci again ran these, and these came out just recently. The risk of extinction with sea lions at present, this is just for the Mackenzie stock, runs somewhere between 30 and 45%, depending on which model you choose. If we can eliminate that predation, the extinction risk drops to 20 to 30%, and it's just naturally higher extinction risk because of their access to the spawning habitat above the dams is blocked. So both of these stocks are at high risk of extinction. The California sea lions are having a measurable and significant effect that, irrespective of everything else that's going on out there. This was a video of a Stella sea lion at the falls. You can see him kind of over towards the right, the kind of blondish male there, and then in the foreground there's a California sea lion. So that's about a one-ton Stella sea lion at the falls and a 600-pound California that looks kind of like a puppy dog next to it. Right now we've got 10 California sea lions at the falls and about 2 Stella sea lions. Again, this is earlier, more animals than we've seen in the past. But this just kind of illustrates the challenge that our folks are going to have trying to remove these animals. And it also illustrates one of the other things that's going on in the Willamette is we've had a major shift in the last year or two towards Stella sea lions, similar to what we saw at Bonneville, where they're displacing the Californias. We had last year hundreds of reports of Stella sea lions in the lower Willamette preying on sturgeon. We had the highest number of Stella sea lions at Willamette Falls itself, up to 10. On one day, and they, in some cases, are displacing the Californias. And again, we are considering applying for a permit at Bonneville to remove Stella sea lions. In the Willamette, as the legislation is currently written, there is no pathway to remove Stellas because they're preying on sturgeon and not salmon steelhead. So they are free reign currently in the Willamette. So this is kind of goes to the emerging issues. We've obviously talked about Willamette Falls and Bonneville. We've also seen California's move into the Sandy and Clackamas systems on the Oregon side. Folks on the Washington side are seeing them in the Cowlitz, Lewis, Alokum, and Kalama, and some other systems. We don't want those systems to go the same way as Willamette. We want to be proactive in these places. And then in the lower Willamette, we're just seeing, as I said, this kind of problem, emerging problem with Stella sea lions. So at Willamette Falls, you heard we applied for a permit under Section 120 last year. NOAA ran a task force this August, and the recommendation of the task force was essentially along the lines of what we asked for, which is minimal conditions on our permit, recognizing the problems that we've had at Bonneville, recognizing the behaviors and the lessons learned. We don't obviously know what conditions NOAA will place on the permit, but that was the recommendation for the task force. We expect to get a permit, or we expect to get a decision in a few weeks here, and we're expecting to be removing some sea lions later on this year at Willamette Falls. And there's a number of features of the falls that lead us to believe that we can be relatively successful there. Those 10 sea lions that we have there right now have been coming for some of them up to a decade, and if we remove them, there's nothing coming in behind them. So we think we can be fairly effective at eliminating that predation, at least on the steelhead, and then moving into April, we'll have to see how successful we are with spring chinook. But good reason to believe that our staff can be successful there. So moving on to the legislation, obviously there's been a big effort between the tribes, states, and a lot of NGOs over the last year and a half to try and move some legislation, originally sponsored by Jamie Herrera-Butler and Kurt Schrader in the House, and successful in getting that passed in the House earlier this year. It's on to the Senate, and there's some productive discussions underway between Senators Cantwell and Merkley to kind of agree on some language in the Senate. And agree on some language that can go back to the House and be successful as well. So I'm optimistic that following the next Tuesday, they'll be moving on that. And kind of the pathway forward here is what we're looking for, at least, is to be able to be proactive in managing sea lions in these locations. We don't want to leave it till it's at the point where Willamette is. The science and our experience kind of suggests that if you can remove the first few before they kind of habituate to these areas, you can prevent the social learning and prevent other animals recruiting, and that's what we're really looking for. Not wait until we have 30, 40 and they're consuming 25% of the population. And doing that by being place-based, so the legislation would designate certain areas in the basin where if an animal is there, it qualifies as individually identifiable, so we no longer have to brand them. Their presence in that area would qualify them for removal. We're also looking to expand the protections to sturgeon and lamprey. Sturgeon, obviously, are a big concern. And lamprey, at Willamette Falls, 15% of the California's diet consists of lamprey, so they may be having an effect there that we just aren't measuring too. There's a few other things that we would like but probably won't get, so these are the main ones we're looking for. And then finally, I kind of want to talk about thinking regionally with this pinniped management. Obviously, there's challenges in Washington and Puget Sound and on the coast. We're challenged in the Columbia Basin. And there's also some issues with predation on the Oregon coast. And so we have a very small and highly specialized group of individuals that have been doing this at Bonneville for the last decade or so. There's maybe three or four people on the Oregon side and one or two people on the Washington side that have been around for 20, 30 years doing this, and they're swiftly retiring. And so as we expand into Willamette and perhaps other areas, there's an urgent need to increase this pool of staff that can do this kind of work. It's, as Nate alluded to, it's dangerous and challenging handling these type of animals, and we don't currently have that pool of staff available to us. So there's a need to grow that relatively quickly. There's also a need to expand the cooperation that's currently occurring at Bonneville to include the tribes more as they're allowed to legislatively, and then kind of work together across the region and share resources. So we're working on that. There's been a group formed between the states, the tribes, the federal agencies to try and get us to the point of regional management, but there's still some ways to go on that. For outside the fence, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife submitted a policy option package to increase our staffing. So I think we asked for 4 to 6 new positions that could implement removals at Willamette, Bonneville, and Clackamas Sandy. That's gone to the governor, and hopefully that's approved in her budget and goes to the legislature, and we should know next year. So that's really all I wanted to talk about. If you have any questions about any of the stuff going on.
Thank you. Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How do you estimate the number of adults that are taken? You've got some estimates there. How do you do that estimation, and do you estimate any smolts that are taken?
We do no smolt estimates, no. For the adult takes, so we have observers at the falls, two observers that are there from January through June, and they basically move around in a stratified manner looking at predation events, and then they try and assign it to first, is it steelhead or chinook, and then is it hatchery or wild, if they can do that, which is difficult in itself. And then if they can't do that, we have another method where we use the window count at the in the fish ladder. So all the fish that go through there are counted and assigned to a run, hatchery, wild, or steelhead or chinook. And based on the proportion of fish that are passing, that predation event is assigned probabilistically to one of those runs. And so that's how we get the estimate.
And you presume you see all predation events?
No. Those two staff rotate around the falls in a stratified manner, and so we expand based on the time that they spend observing there to the times that they're not there and expand it that way.
Let me rephrase that. Do you think there are any underwater predation events that your observers are not seeing in their stratified observations?
Not on adult salmon steelhead. Our marine mammal folks tell us that when they take an adult salmon steelhead, they have to come to the surface to eat it. They may be consuming smolts under the surface that we're not seeing, and they have done some scat analysis to look at that as well.
Mr. Thorburn?
I have a question about one of the slides. It's the graph that shows the comparison of the steelhead population with the sea lions. It's entitled Sea Lion Numbers Increasing. Yeah, that one. So I know it's not a real long period, not quite 20 years, but it appears that steelhead were on the decline fairly considerably before there were many sea lions. So does that imply that there were other issues contributing? Predator control becomes so much more important when you're dealing with these small disappearing populations. Were there other issues contributing to decline of steelhead in the Willamette system, and have those issues been dealt with? Because it seems to be an important question with this kind of touchy subject.
Yeah, and this graph isn't meant to imply causation here. It's just kind of overlaying one over the other. Certainly there are other issues associated with the decline of steelhead and spring chinook. They were listed in late 90s because of other factors. There was no California sea lions around at the time they were listed. And those factors were all the standard ones you can list. Both the states and the federal agencies and others are working to address those. There's been significant hatchery reform, harvest reform, habitat, a lot of action on habitat. There's ongoing actions on hydro. There's still plenty of work to do there, but this is kind of the final nail in the coffin. The other thing we had here is in 2015 we had that really bad drought, bad ocean conditions following that, so that run got really hammered. And then on top of that, we had 25% predation of those returning adults. So that's why we had 500 fish last year or 2 years ago. So there are other factors, but if we can't deal with this one, then all the actions we're going to take elsewhere are not going to benefit the fish because they won't be around.
Thank you.
Cheers.
All right, I'm last. I'll bring up the rear and talk about something a little bit different. I'm going to talk about the Killer Whale Task Force now, and it certainly has discussed all the topics that you've heard about already today, but it's also a little bit broader, so we'll cover those again. So, first of all, Governor Inslee put out an executive order in March of this last year, and that executive order outlined two basic things. One, he asked the state agencies to do some immediate things within existing resources, and then the other piece was establishing a Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force to bring folks together to work on how to implement meaningful actions for recovery of the species. At the same time, he was able to work on some supplemental funding that went to the state agencies so that we could start moving immediately on the actions that were possible. So our agency has been working really hard since we got that funding on several different pieces, and here's just a few that are on that list. We did an exercise with NOAA that looked at the prioritization of Chinook stocks that may be most important for southern residents, which will help us tailor a lot of these actions to where they might be most beneficial to orcas. In addition, we went through the North of Falcon process and talked about killer whales in relation to our fisheries. We also increased hatchery production with some funding that we received from the legislature, and were asked to do an assessment of the current level of PCBs that are in our fish food for our hatcheries to ensure that those weren't something that would be compromising to killer whales as well. We also have been looking at the current funding that we're using for habitat restoration for Chinook already and seeing how those overlay and might benefit southern residents. And we've been, as Nate mentioned, doing quite a bit of work on pinnipeds, including putting some new information together that will help us move forward that might also end up benefiting southern resident killer whales. And then lastly, we were able to support two new officers who are based in Puget Sound who are focused on enforcing the vessel regulations that currently exist for southern residents to keep people a good distance away from them. So the task force was charged with identifying, prioritizing, and supporting the implementation of this plan that they're working on putting together for the benefit of southern residents. The governor put together a pretty diverse group of individuals on this task force, and it was with the goal of being inclusive. So we have about 45 members who are involved, and it includes everyone from different state agencies all the way to tribal members, stakeholders who may be affected by any of the recommendations that the group might come up, as well as conservation organizations and other interested parties. If that wasn't enough, we needed more groups, so we made three more with the idea that that large group is not going to be able to dig into the major threats around killer whales. Let's get some folks with more expertise and speciality to look at what are the major threats around three things: lack of prey. And on that group, myself and Steve Martin from Governor Salmon Recovery Office have been helping to facilitate that process. And we had great participation from ODF&W on the prey working group, including Sean and Chris, who you heard from recently. And then there were a group that was focused on vessels and a group that was focused on contaminants. And those were led by other state agencies. Through this hectic schedule, essentially what those working groups did was to come up with potential actions that could help to address the threats that they were assigned to. And then through this iterative process that you see on the screen up here, we had a series of discussions with the working groups and the task force, where the task force would give the working groups instructions, the working groups would go and do their work, come up with some thoughts and recommendations to the task force and deliver those, and then go back and forth answering questions and try to get the recommendations to a place where the task force, which is the decision making body, will be able to do their work. During this process, we also tried to provide quite a lot of information for both the working groups and task force members, including several webinars on issues that might be pretty complicated and needed some more explanation, including things like spill on the Columbia was one of the things that we talked about, as well as the Lower Snake River dams, which has certainly got a lot of attention from the public. In addition, we've had a couple opportunities for the public to send in comment, and all of those comments have been collated and sent to the task force. In addition, we've got hundreds of letters from organizations who represent many thousands of people who've been interested in the process. So there's been no lack of interest in this by any means. What their first assignment is to do is to come up with this report that is due on November 16th. And so that is coming up really shortly. And the final meeting that the task force has in order to make decisions on the recommendations that will appear in that report is on Tuesday. So things are starting to shape up more and more as the process goes on. The contents of this first report are really, like I said, addressing those three major threats, with a focus on the timing of this report coming out so that specific budget request for Washington State will hopefully get moved through the governor's budget, and then will be presented to the legislature for other needs that might be out there, either for policy or budget, in order to implement those recommendations. And then there are also, as you can imagine, several places in those recommendations where we couldn't get all 45 people to agree. And so the report will also include those minority opinions in those cases, as well as a list of other issues that the task force did not tackle this year, but is possible for them to discuss in 2019. So this task force will dissolve after October 1st, 2019. So after this first report goes out, there's plenty of time for them to work on other issues they haven't already gotten to, as well as to follow up on the implementation of the recommendations that are going to appear in this first November 16th report. So within the three major threats, the working groups focused on several different issues. Within the prey working group, you heard Nate talk about the four H's of salmon recovery, and that was certainly the basis for a lot of the discussion that the working group had. But the members also wanted to ensure that both forage fish and food web concerns were discussed within that, as well as predation. So we focused on those six topics within the prey working group. And that working group helped to give some critique and analysis to this list of priority stocks for southern residents that I mentioned before. Up here you have the top 12 that exist, with in yellow ones that either Oregon and Washington share or might be in Oregon. And I think this just highlights that collaboration that is going to be needed between our two states so that we can be successful in this realm. This is a extremely abbreviated version of what the recommendations might look like. There have been several iterations, and they're currently still evolving over time, but the recommendations will be discussed, like I said, for the final time on this Tuesday. And some of the recommendations that have been discussed and look like have pretty broad support include things like increasing hatchery production to benefit southern residents. And what's been on the table as a recommendation is to ensure that we are getting that level of funding that we've already received for increasing production, but then significantly increasing that level of production to benefit southern residents and as well as provide fishery benefits. In addition, the recommendation also speaks to some pilot studies that our scientists would really like to undergo in order to look at hatchery production and how we might be able to either minimize predation on outgoing smolts, look at run timing that might be most beneficial for southern residents, look at potentially any differences in size that might be able to be done through different practices and hatcheries, and a number of different other things that we can try in order to adjust the way that we do our hatchery management that could benefit southern residents. Of course, habitat restoration and acquisition, as well as protection and incentives for private landowners, have been huge topics that the task force has discussed. And I expect that those components will all be things that will appear in the final recommendations. Within hydro, there have been lots of different discussions there. One important one I think that several members have definitely fought for is the reintroduction and reestablishment of runs where that might be possible in blocked areas, as well as the removal of dams and not just the discussion around the Lower Snake River Dam, but many other dams that are already gone through the process of working through communities and are essentially shovel ready, but just needing resources in order to remove those smaller non-main stem sort of dams. And then a lot of discussion around potentially increasing the total dissolved gas caps so that increased spill would be allowed, depending on what the science says about what might be most beneficial to salmon. And on the predation front, like I said, the task force has touched on all the topics that were discussed here today, but there are three different recommendations around predation that have maintained a lot of momentum throughout. One is on predatory fish in particular, and that includes looking at some reservoir management that might be possible, as well as looking at potential fisheries management changes that might help us get at some of those issues that were talked about earlier. And then the other two are around pinnipeds, and the task force had essentially split out the pinniped discussion into looking at the Columbia River and Bonneville situation, and then separately talking about the Puget Sound situation. And I think part of that discussion really hinged on there are some very tangible, real things that the task force could help with in the Columbia in particular. So you'll see in that recommendation there is specifically language in there about supporting the bill that has been in Congress and or the application that Nate talked about and the changes that are in the in process right now. And then slightly differently in Puget Sound, in a place where we don't currently have authorization or a congressional bill, a lot of discussion about how to put the science together appropriately, make sure that, as Nate indicated, that we have all of the regionally specific information we would need in order to move towards management. And then that recommendation, I believe, reads to establish a management panel of the appropriate entities in order to move forward and work on that. And in particular, it also calls out that artificial haulout removal might be one of the immediate actions that could happen that we could start more immediately to have an effect in Puget Sound. And in harvest recommendations, you'll see things like trying to have some more discussions about reductions in bycatch on the West Coast, and, of course, implementing and funding the Pacific Salmon Treaty, which, of course, has a lot of connections all to hatcheries and habitat as well. Under vessels, and most of all of these vessel regulations are really confined more to the Puget Sound area, there's discussion of including a go slow regulation around the whales. So in the upper right hand corner of the slide, you can see there that we have our current regulation in red, where you have to remain 200 yards away from the whales and you can't be 400 yards in front of them. And so that go slow regulation would essentially be putting a larger buffer around that, which would ask vessels to go slower, which would reduce the amount of sound that reaches the whales and would allow them to more effectively forage and communicate. In addition, there's some new research out there about the potential for echo sounders to emit noise at a level that is exactly consistent with the clicking noises that are used by the whales when they're foraging. So there's some work going on with the Marine Trade Association and others in order to see what might be done on that front. Some whale watching permitting is also being discussed, as well as some things around larger vessels, including ferries and how to make them quieter, as well as doing some cross-boundary things with Canada on shipping. And in addition, there's also discussion about potentially establishing a no-go zone in an area that we know is a high foraging priority. On the contaminants recommendations, here's just four that I pulled out. I believe there are about eight that are on the list, but some at the federal level, which you can see there through the Toxic Substances Control Act, and then others at the statewide ban for PCBs is one of the things that's being discussed, trying to make that a faster transition. And then, of course, some stormwater threats. And so this is applicable not just to Puget Sound, of course, but to everywhere. I think we have some good data that shows that stormwater has some pretty dramatic effects on some fish populations in a few areas. So if we can focus on those, especially where they overlap with what's most important for southern residents, that might give us a lot of bang for our buck. So as I said, the next steps includes the meeting that's going to happen on the 6th, and that's in Puyallup at the State Fairgrounds. I will definitely be there, and Commissioner Smith, who is the commission seat, will be there, as well as Amy Windrup from WDFW. The year one report will come out on November 16th, and immediately we'll work on some outreach to the public on what it means to be in that report, as well as start working with the governor's office on ensuring that we have any funding needs that are there. And then start working on implementation with all the partners who've been sitting around the table together. And then, as I mentioned before, then we need to really start into year two and make sure that we've had the task force deal with all the outstanding issues. Just wanted to leave on a last note, getting back to what we talked about earlier with the PREA recommendations. One of the big ones that we thought you would be interested in connects to hatchery production. And here again, just as the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission put forward a pinniped management policy, there was also one around hatchery production. And so as we're looking through those recommendations and trying to figure out how to implement them and to ask for appropriate funding, we're certainly following what is here you see on the screen and looking at some pretty dramatic increases in hatchery production. Up to 50 million smolts might be possible. So I think with that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Becker. Questions from the front?
That's very good.
Yes, Mr. McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a question, but maybe just another point of emphasis on that last slide about the commission's motion to try to test the prey hypothesis of increasing Chinook salmon to try to address the concern that there's not enough prey. And in the discussions from the Washington Commission, we looked at this 50 million smolt level, which included 30 million in Puget Sound and 20 million on the Columbia River. And this was just a proposal, but it went through the Columbia River and carefully looked at areas where you might be able to enhance the release of hatchery Chinook salmon, where concerns about impacts on wild Chinook salmon would be minimized. And on that list, there was a couple of spots in Oregon. And so there may be a situation where you all, as the policy body for the Fish and Wildlife Commission, or Fish and Wildlife Department, might be considering whether or not you'd be receptive to the state of Oregon contributing to this killer whale prey enhancement idea. I'm sure you might start to think about money, and in the end, we do hope that the federal government, who is looking at trying to give a clean bill of health to a new biological opinion on endangered killer whales and doing something more for them, would be contributing to the cost of it. You've been hearing about the Washington governor's task force, and this 50 million increase is still in play in that arena, but in the end, some Washington money has a high chance of being considered to do something here. But I just bring it to your attention because a couple of spots in Oregon do meet the stock list of finding genetic strains that migrate to places where the killer whales can take advantage of them as prey, and those included the upper Willamette and Bonneville Hatchery, where perhaps some of the number two and three stocks on the list were lower Columbia River Tules or upper River Brights. Those fit that genetic strain migration pattern. There's also some innovative thinking going on now about some spots in the Snake River that might again come to your table for a question of whether you would endorse getting involved in increased hatchery production to help benefit the killer whales. And again, our focus had been trying to carefully find areas where the impacts on wild fish are not going to be as big a concern as has been in the past for more broad spread hatchery releases.
Yes, Commissioner Baker.
In Washington, the governor's budgets will come out in about 6 weeks. And the final report is due in November 16th. I think we are all feeling the pressure of having no time. We're out of time on this issue if we're going to do anything. And I believe one of the tasks of the task force is to stage these responses so that we can start soon, and it'll be an ongoing effort many, many years into the future. So how is the task force interacting with the governor on, for instance, just as an example, the hatchery increases that we voted out unanimously? And do we expect some portion of that, at least the places where there is ability to start upping production right away, are we pushing for that from the task force perspective?
Yes, Commissioner Baker, that is definitely on all of our mind about having very little time between when the report comes out and when the governor's budget comes out. We certainly haven't been waiting this whole time just for the final decision. We've had a lot of indications of where these recommendations are going, and we have certainly policy direction from our own agency as it is. So in addition to the decision packages that the agency's already put in, we've been anticipating that there would be additional killer whale needs. So the Office of Financial Management has both been working with us, WDFW, on our requests, as well as intimately involved in the task force process. And so those things overlap really quite nicely. And so they've already asked the state agencies to let them know what are asks that the agencies already put in that will serve as helpful to make the recommendation successful, as well as are there any other things that are outstanding that we have to deliver, I believe, by next week, that are not already in your asks from the agency. So we're already working on those two bits. And I think specifically you mentioned the hatchery recommendation. The question that OFM has for the agencies is, what do you need in order to make these recommendations successful? And so our answers back to them are consistent with what, you know, we've been directed to do and what we think are most beneficial for Southern residents.
And Penny, I'll just piggyback on that a little bit, that in the discussions around the task force, the recognition is very real that whatever report we come up with, unless there's a funding package that goes along with it, it's a moot point pretty much. So that's an overlay at all. And while it is difficult to get consensus around 45 people, I've been impressed by the amount of consensus that is there. The last meeting, we had to all go around and give our thoughts about the meeting that just occurred. And I said a word that hasn't come into my lexicon for a long time, optimism, was forthcoming out of that meeting, because you did see a lot of people coming together. So it's not unanimous, but you know, unanimity is not going to happen. But it is, I'm encouraged. So.
Yeah, I guess just on that same point, one of the things that the task force has recognized is that this body is not charged to start everything from the beginning, right? We have salmon recovery already occurring within the lead entities and the regional organizations, and so the task force is simply supporting that. We have hatchery production already, decision makers already in the agency, and so let's support those efforts and move it forward. So I think the task force is going to lend a lot of support to a lot of the things that we as an agency already value.
And I think the task force will also provide air cover in terms of trying to get legislation passed, because regardless of whether it's an R or a D sitting in a governor's office, this will not come out as that person's program. It's the task force recommendations. So,
good camouflage.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
That was very informative. One last quick question.
Done.
No, I had to, again, going on the east side of the Mississippi again. And not to put anything else on this table, but do the words sea, parasitic sea lamprey or Asian carp enter into any conversations yet?
No? Green crabs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We don't need any of those.
I know. I just, well, you know, it depends on where you're looking, because it's just like chronic wasting disease, you know. It's, thank you. Oh,
one second.